There'll be spectacle, there'll be fantasy, there'll be daring do and stuff like you would never see.
Hey, an actor!
Yeah, we're gonna be a movie
starring everybody
and me. There'll be heroes bold, there'll be comedy, and a lot of fun that is for us to happily.
Hey, an actor!
We can watch it on develop
starring everybody
and Jamie Foxx. Hello and welcome to Hey An Actor, the film podcast of legends, where we, the Brothers Wilson, talk about one actor, three films, and lots of other silliness in between. My name is Pandy, or that's what I go by at the very least, and I'm joined, as always, by me wonderful brother, the stand-up comic of the year, Ian Wilson.
In his fifth decade.
In his fifth... Oh, yes, of course.
Yes.
Because last time we recorded... Apologies for the delay.
Yeah, yeah. We took the summer off, basically.
Yeah. We're getting a habit of that now. And, yeah. You know, some monumental things happens.
Yes.
You turned 40. You started a new career.
That's not quite true. I'm still in the same job.
Tidied the office. But, yeah, how's it diddling, me brother?
Oh, well, busy summer. So, yes, we recorded just before I was about to fly off to Croatia.
Of course.
To start off the 2 weeks of my birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And Croatia was very nice.
Lovely.
Would recommend. Lovely water.
So I hear, and lovely garbage chutes. It's all automated. It all goes underground. It's very important, Andrew.
That's a lot of... Oh, right, okay.
Very impressive.
I see. Those long car journeys, eh? not something that I particularly remarked upon, but if one will holiday with their parents, then there you go.
I didn't holiday with my parents at all.
Well, no,
just
no, that's
the thing. They
see
each other very often because they live nearby.
Yes. Moreover, that's something clearly Dan picked up upon. Well, it's more of a, you know, mainland Europe kind of thing.
Yes, it is.
Because I have it in the Netherlands as well. But in any event, was abroad, was here domestically. You and I and your good lady went to see a show in the West End.
We saw Les Mis.
We did indeed.
Spoiler alert, much better live than the film.
Well, I mean... The quality of singing was another level.
And I've listened to it many times since on Spotify.
Ah.
Which
the original
is,
cast?
The 25-year anniversary.
Oh, okay.
It came up first in my search.
The original cast has Peter Mannion from The Thick of It as Javert.
Yes.
Yep.
Peter Mannion MP.
Indeed. And then it has... Father Pierce Harmon of Ultraviolet as Javert in the 25th anniversary one.
Cool.
Like literally the first room we covered on Tab How. and then had a nice meal with the sister afterwards. And then since returning to the north, I've had my decking ripped out.
Yeah.
Installed... I believe, formerly of your own possession, a movable desk.
Yeah, my hydraulic my first hydraulic desk have now bequeathed.
Yes, it's
down the family line.
I've been working on it this very morning.
Oh, so, great.
There we go. What Pandy has been alluding to is, whilst I was gearing up for the birthday, I was on an 8-week comedy course, which culminated in a... 250 capacity show.
That's with, quite a difference.
Which, I mean, don't get me wrong, there was quite a lot of people there. Myself and 19 others performed. And it all went very well, to the extent we're now all on WhatsApp with each other and just doing it on the side.
Planning comedy gigs together.
Yeah, we've planned a gig for the end of October. So,
would you like to share the name of your comedy troupe?
We are the Cunny Funts.
Disgusting.
It's only disgusting if you're aware of what a spoonerism is.
I suppose so.
And what about your summer, brother?
I've been away. So I'm not a teacher anymore, so I don't get all 6 weeks off. But I've managed to cram in quite a lot, which has been nice. Had a nice week in Blackpool.
Ooh, for glamour.
I tell you what, if you feel bad about your body image, brother, head to Blackpool. It will make you feel very, very confident in your dress sense, your size, and your ability to parent.
Right.
Because, oh good God, this country is fucked. No. Maybe it's just because we were staying in a haven.
Name them, why don't you?
Oh, it was, yeah. I mean, we had a nice time. We went to the Tower Ballroom in Blackpool, the famous global dancing hotspot, and I can say that I have danced with my wife and my daughter on the famous Blackpool floor. I also danced with my son in the wings. He didn't really want to go out there, but it was a wonderful feeling. That was very nice. There's also some air shows. Meh. And then we did a big old holiday. When I say big old, a lot of people from my daughter's baby group, who are now all kind of a lot older, because they're not babies anymore.
Pushing 10.
Good God, I nearly have a 10-year-old daughter. fucking hell. And yeah, so we went to this Welsh hotel, which was awful. It was very dirty, badly appointed. And you know what? Again, it made me feel really good about my ability to parent, because some of those little cunts, honestly... Will you shut up and stop beating your parents? Or they go, oh, isn't he a character? Come on, time to go to bed. It made me so, so cross. But we climbed Mount Snowdon, and yes, that was a wonderful thing, to take the kids up to the top of the mountain and back down again. It was a nice kind of parental accomplishment. So, you know, I've returned back to work end of August, beginning of September with a new leash on life and ready to carry on podcasting.
Lovely stuff. Lovely stuff.
Yeah.
So this has been, as we say, a few months in the making, but we are going with an actor that Pandy chose. And that is Mr. Jamie Foxx.
Jamie Foxx. Now, we've seen him already in quite a few films.
We'll come
back to that a little bit later on.
Yeah, we will.
But today's episode, we will finish. Our highlights coming up is the Tarantino Wild West amazingness of Django Unchained. Not to give away my hands too early. Before that, a vastly superior film, even to that, one of my favourite films in terms of rewatch value, is the Gerald Butler two-hander, Law-Abiding Citizen.
Which I've not seen before.
Not seen before. And then we're starting, in just a second after this little clip, with the film that I had not seen before. That film being the Ray Charles biopic, Ray.
Ray, I ain't gonna beat around the bush with you. You going blind. The doctor saying nothing they can do, so we gotta do it ourselves. Remember how many stairs there were?
Four.
Good.
Now what we're gonna do, I'm gonna teach you three notes. And this is the first note right here. Play that.
How y'all doing tonight?
Ray Charles saw the world in ways no one could imagine.
I hear like you see, like that hummingbird outside the window, for instance.
I can't hear, huh?
You hear that? A heart just skipped a beat.
He broke barriers no one thought possible.
If you want me to do something special, I'm gonna need my own band.
Okay, but you're gonna have to make it work, Ray.
Yeah, well, I'm gonna make it do what it do, baby. Yeah.
Played what no one else dared.
Nobody's ever combined R&B and gospel before.
You're turning God's music into sex.
All of y'all going straight to hell.
If all of y'all want me to keep playing, let me hear you say amen. Hey! You know I had my eye on y'all, Nayla. You
feels a risk because he figures that's the way to tell if she's good looking or not.
How you feeling, Ray?
Groovy, baby.
You give your hand to me.
Are those drugs worth losing everything?
And I can hardly speak.
Ray, this isn't some judge in Indiana. Our lawyers will do what they can, but...
When I walk out that door, I walk out alone in the dark. I'm trying to do something that nobody ever done in music and business.
The innovator of soul, Ray Charles!
I'm doing romance.
We're giving you a state-of-the-art deal here.
Since I'm producing my own records, I was wondering if I could own my masters, too.
Ray, we've never done that before.
That's a better deal than Sinatra gets.
Yeah.
Jamie Foxx. Ray. A Taylor Hackford film.
Ray is a 2004 biographical film of the blind musician and pianist Ray Charles, starring Jamie Foxx as the titular Ray, but also starring lots of other people, many of whom I don't know. Terrence Howard, yep. The original War Machine, but not quite, was in there. Also Warwick Davis, for some reason.
Yes.
And then from the Wikipedia entry, Kerry Washington, Clifton Powell, Harry Lennox, there's another operating system, and some others. And it tells the story of his upbringing, interspersed with his career and how he started as a kind of pianist for hire, kind of trekking his way away from his native Florida to try and work his way up through the club scene, him having to navigate shitty business practices, and his addiction woes, which started reasonably early on. It's a film I had not seen before. I was obviously familiar with it because it garnered Jamie Foxx his Oscar.
It did.
For Best Actor. Mm. You had seen it before, brother. When was the first time you saw Ray?
I think it was back in my Love Film days.
Right.
So, I mean, my exposure to Ray Charles has just been the Blues Brothers, really. It's just a big kind of blind spot in my music history.
That's a poor turn of phrase.
not intended. But, I mean, I wouldn't have been able to have told you a single other Ray Charles song before that. So,
really? Not even Hit the Road, Jack, and Don't You Come Back?
You see, I didn't know whether that was his song, specifically.
Oh, okay. So you knew the song, just not affiliated.
Oh, I knew the song. You know,
got you.
It's been on adverts and all. But, but yes, Hit the Road, Jack is very good. But I'd struggle to confirm whether or not I knew about Georgia on My Mind or, you know, all the other hits. However,
which you can remember them all.
Exactly. So, it was something that I wanted to address. So I did watch it, but it was around the time that I was kind of going off, biopics because we've gone through quite a few of them on this podcast over the years, brother.
Indeed.
Usually because, they're very easy Oscar bait. case in point. And that's not to take away to the performance of Fox or anyone, which we'll obviously come to. But it was just a case of, okay, it has won an Oscar. I'm now a lot more familiar with Jamie Foxx. I think this was probably just before or just after I'd seen Django for the first time.
Okay.
So, you know.
Oh, that's a huge difference in performing.
Absolutely. But, I anticipated that as well, but you know, wanting to like see what his kind of range was. So Love Film. So when I was in Biddleston Towers, basically. So probably.
Okay.
It would be a bit over 10 years ago at this point, but.
Fine.
So I saw it. I found it interesting. I think the fact that the cast kind of came and went, again, kind of made me think, okay, it's your standard biopic, really. Great central performance. That's what the film needed. That's what the film delivered. And, yeah, so that's, but I found it impressive, basically. So, sure. Coming back to it, I think roughly, I feel exactly the same, to be honest. this was your first time watching it, brother. What did you think Indeed. About Ray?
I mean, you've kind of hit the nail on the head in terms of the phrase standard biopic.
Mm.
As in, I was watching it thinking, we've seen this film, we've covered this film, we've done so many kind of biopics now, that you kind of know all the different things to look out for, and the where the montage is here, and how like there's a big kind of the rise in the career is always a montage, and there are so many beats. Now, that's not to do down the life of an artist, because obviously Ray Charles had quite a rich and varied career, as the phrase goes. And I didn't know a huge amount about Ray Charles, but apparently a little bit more than you did. Definitely Blues Brothers, first and foremost, would have been the first time I knew it,
yeah.
of him. But had definitely heard at least one of his albums first at some point. What I liked about this film, to make it just stand out just a little bit more than the others, was the fact that his history was kind of laced throughout. And there was kind of him coming across a situation and then looking back, again, poor turn of phrase, but thinking back to a previous time in his life when, you know, his mother said this, or, you know, why he had a kind of panic attack, feeling like there was water splashing around, to think back about tragedy in his past.
Mm.
So in terms of the way the biopic is told, there are variances and there are nuances which make it interesting enough to kind of carry on. And that's not to say that the life of Ray Charles wasn't interesting as well, because it's quite an incredible story. It's a blind musician who, according to this film, has the powers of Daredevil.
Mm.
In order to identify everything around him in his wits, obviously with limitations. Plus he gets hooked on heroin.
Yeah.
But then kind of finding himself and finding his voice and, you know, him finding a family finding a woman who will put up with him and be very troubled by what happens to him, but still allowing it because he's an artist and because she loves him so much. But it's an amazing story of this one guy. And even though I don't have like a huge affinity for Ray Charles or, you know, a deep-seated love for his music from knowing him for years and years and years, I don't have that. You can still end the film kind of going, wow, that's amazing. And it's carried by a very, very strong performance with lots and lots and lots of kind of closely resembling tics and eccentricities from Jamie Foxx.
Yeah. I mean, I think going on to what you said about the kind of structure of the film, I found it interesting. I did think the wraparound of the visions of the drowning brother, to what extent that's, I mean, I'm sure that actually happened. It wasn't a contrivance for the actual plot of the film. I wonder whether or not that did plague him as much as he says, because this is ultimately a film that Charles wasn't actually involved in the making of, necessarily.
Not hugely, but he did have a kind of, I'd say, a glance at or a look over. He didn't look at the, he was able to review the
glance
script.
And look, okay. Right.
I'm so sorry. We're not trying to be horrid.
No.
Just a poor turn of phrase.
And ultimately, he didn't get to see the film before it.
Jesus.
Because he died before it was released. Like, literally, yes, within months before it opened. So, yeah, I mean, so generally he was supportive of the project, and there are things about the biopic inevitably that cover over some of the less glamorous things about his lifestyle. I mean, notwithstanding, it's, you know, it puts his drug addiction fairly front and centre.
Yeah.
His relationship with Della, again, plays a bit fast and loose with time, Like he had been married before having ever met her, for example. and, you know, and then there's a kind of big gap between his rehab in 1965 and then the scene at the end in 1979 where he receives his apology from the state of Georgia.
Indeed.
And that would have been the same year that he would have been filming Blues Brothers, because that came out in 1980. So,
oh, of course. Yeah. I didn't make that time leap.
Mm.
That's very cool.
So that's the story. And I should mention that the story and the screenplay are handled by a James L. White, who I have nothing to say about, because I don't know anything about him. And
makes it sound like he's wronged you in the past. I have nothing to say about him.
And Taylor Hackford, aka who's the director, aka Mr. Helen Mirren.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So cool. They got married at the end of the 90s, and he, in his own right, is, you know, he directs and writes things from time to time. He's more of a director. He's directed things such as An Officer and a Gentleman.
Of course.
Richard Gere film where he wears a naval costume. I'm sure there's more to it than that. he directed...
Well, there's obviously a gentleman there as well.
Well, exactly. and he directed the film for which Phil Collins provided the song Against All Odds, which is
okay.
Against All Odds.
Oh.
and many more.
I legitimately didn't know.
Yeah.
What film was that? Oh, I see.
Well, they splice clips of the film into the music video.
Got you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, with that all out the way, Jamie Foxx's Ray Charles.
Like I say, tour de force. Mm. Very impressed. Ray Charles is quite an iconic look, has quite an iconic yes. look. And Jamie Foxx was wearing prosthetics over his eyes when, you know, there were scenes where his glasses were off.
Those scenes are literally the only ones where I can actually physically see Jamie Foxx.
That's fair.
Again, not to play on vision and everything, but like usually the glasses do a very good job of making it less obvious. Because when you've got like an image of Jamie Foxx in your head, you know, by and large, it's not present throughout the film.
No. And, you know, there's kind of the way Ray Charles speaks is interesting. The way he moves is interesting. A kind of mixture of his kind of anxieties plus tweaking from his drug addiction.
Yeah.
And then when he's playing, he's kind of rocking as well and throwing his head back. And I think I read that he didn't sing much on this film's soundtrack.
No.
Jamie Foxx. I could tell that was a bit of a thing for me. But, you know, when he's acting in the scenes and kind of, you know, moving around, he's a spot.
Sorry?
he's a spot. He's okay. a spitting image.
Right, okay.
He's a spot likeness.
Okay.
They look similar.
Sure. No, I get that bit. It's just spot.
He's the spot.
Okay.
Read contextual clues.
Okay, fine. But yes, I mean, apart from like early cover versions, by and large, it isn't Fox doing the singing.
No. Mm. And it does the thing at the end of the film that I don't like when they do it. And they did it in the Tina Turner biopic where, like, you know, we have watched Jamie Fox be Ray Charles all the way through the film.
Yeah.
And then right at the end of the film, we don't see Jamie Foxx as Ray Charles. We see actual Ray Charles. Now, I know that we are celebrating the life of Ray Charles in this film.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't want you to finish a biopic and... Well, actually, maybe that's what the filmmakers want you to do. But I kind of feel like the actor gets a bit shortchanged. So Angela...
You feel it takes you out of the film.
I mean, I guess it does. It kind of just draws a line and goes, yes, and all the way through the film, you've not been watching this person.
Yes. That was Angela Bassett. Now, here's the real thing.
Exactly. Yeah. And that really wound me up at the end of the Tina Turner biopic, when she's done all the heavy lifting throughout the film. Yes, I know she had the life and had to endure Ike Turner.
Mm.
But, you know, she's going to do pretty well out of this film, is Tina Turner. Let Angela Bassett sing the last song? And okay, fine. Ray Charles is just on stage holding his hands up going, yay. But it would have been great to have, you know, grown-up Ray Charles and Ray Charles and his grown-up children on stage, like, recreating that moment, and then it cuts to a picture of him or something. It just seems a bit lazy.
Okay. That's fair.
It's a personal thing. I completely understand why they did it. I just don't like the way it kind of pulls the rug out. You know, they've kind of whipped the tablecloth off. All the stuff's remained on the table, but it's moved just that little bit.
There you go, spoiling magician's secrets as usual.
It's not a magician's secret to whip out tablecloths.
No, it's part of a magician's act, isn't it?
A very bad magician. Very bad musician.
Very bad.
Naughty, naughty magician.
Ray Charles, a very bad... Did you say musician or magician?
I'm not musician, magician. Oh, is that why you got confused?
Possibly.
It's Ray Charles the musician, who's not taught by Maggie Magpie.
Yeah.
There's sugar in ice cream! Abracadabra!
Yes, the most famous magician that Pandy could think of was a magpie puppet on an irritating YouTube series.
It's Steve and Maggie and Ray Charles!
Has Link grown out of that yet?
Unfortunately, they have.
Oh, good.
I missed Steve and Maggie.
YouTube
twats now.
A colleague at work was talking about Steve and Maggie last week.
Oh, amazing!
Her children are 11, 6, and 3. So the 3-year-old boy really loves Steve and Maggie.
Good boy.
Clearly the 6-year-old girl probably watched it as well. So, yeah. Anyway.
Go away, scary monsters. Go away. Go away.
So,
anyway.
Steve and Maggie and Ray Charles.
It's like we've never been away. So the supporting cast then. So they dart around Ray's life, and obviously there are some people who are consistent, some people who leave pretty quickly. And I've already said that I didn't recognise a huge amount of people from the ensemble. I found Warwick Davis in there to be like completely left field.
Yes.
And at one point in his last scene, he completely abandons any pretense of an accent as well.
You say Warwick Davis isn't a very good actor.
I am not saying that.
No. You already insulted him on Twitter once.
I didn't insult him.
He responded to something you said about him.
I think he thought I was making a joke about his height, but I wasn't.
Yeah.
I don't think. I can't remember. Twitter's dead to me.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. Yes, so I mean, I recognise a fair few people. So you've got Kerry Washington playing his wife, Della B. Kerry Washington, very well established in her own right. We'll be talking about her again later on. And then you mentioned Terence Howard, who's one of his early kind of musician, quote-unquote, friends. Not a good friend.
No.
Harry Lennox, the operating system, as you refer to him as. You might recall, he played a musician on House in the first.
Ooh, Harry Lennox?
Yeah.
Oh, of course, yeah. He played the guy with the gruff voice who had ALS.
That's the one.
Yeah. No, I forgot. I recognise his picture now. I didn't recognise the name.
Moreover, he's perhaps more famous as being the kind of dickish rival to Morpheus in the Matrix sequels.
That's right.
The one who's...
married to Niobe.
Yes. Or at the very least, her partner.
The Will Smith in the cucking relationship of Zion.
Yeah. And then... there are other people. You've got Richard Schiff from The West Wing. You've got Kurt Fuller from Ghostbusters 2. He's the guy who's is Sam Clark at the record company.
Oh yeah,
recognize Kurt Fuller.
I do recognize him. Yes.
And then you've also got David Krumholtz,
From your part.
Adam's Family Values. As Wednesday's love interest, and then he's in like the Santa Claus and all sorts.
He's actually in Oppenheimer as well.
He is in Oppenheimer, yes. Yes.
Yeah. He's had a rich and varied career.
He's not gone hungry, as David Krumholtz.
I know, I saw him in Oppenheimer. That's not fair.
He could well have been wearing a fat suit. What I meant is he's a regular present on stage and screen.
A busy boy.
A busy boy indeed. But I think the thing with this kind of film and a supporting cast is they are literally just there to garnish the kind of main performance in a way that other films that aren't of this nature don't, or it's much easier for different types of films to be ensembles. Whereas it's very much, this is the story about Ray Charles. This is the powerhouse performance you're getting. Yeah, Kerry Washington might get nominated for supporting actress or something. But, you know, if they're putting all their eggs into the Academy Awards basket, then it will be for the best male actor performance. And maybe the Sandra Bullock Award for sound editing.
Yeah. And to that end, it's a very coherent film with an engaging story, a real story, albeit through the prism of someone else saying, no, change that, please. Hmm. It's a long film, but I didn't feel all of its runtime. Because he had a long career, he don't want to do anything out. And obviously they missed out an entire marriage.
Yes.
What? Yeah. So, okay, they're talking about his career rather than his life, although I guess his life is there as well because it's a biopic. Anyway, they hit upon a lot of his life, albeit getting rid of some of the things that don't fit a narrative structure. But and what I'm saying is it kind of dragged at some points for me. Is going, come on, let's move it on, move it on, move it on. But eventually, you know, it's an interesting film that I enjoyed. I would also say that I was very pleased to see the appearance of Ahmet Ertegun.
Okay.
Who, when he passed away, sadly, in 2006, there was a kind of Atlantic Records, not tribute concert. There was a sort of, I guess, a tribute concert to him and to Atlantic Records. And it was the triumphant return, albeit for one night, of Led Zeppelin. Who came back together to headline that gig. They released it as a separate album, with the original lineup. With the songs massively detuned so that Robert Plant could sing them. Most notably with Jason Bonham on the drums rather than John Bonham, his son. So it was a kind of a nice moment of, you know, how lovely is this? I then wanted them to come back and do more stuff, but they didn't want to. Never mind.
You've got to see certain people.
I've been in the presence of John Paul Jones.
Yes.
At the Taylor Hawkins tribute show, which I rewatched.
I took that picture of your smiling face.
Oh, I was so happy.
Yeah.
There's a smiling photo and then another one later on of me going, oh my God, it's John Paul Jones! Fucking hell! I was more excited to see him than all the members of Queen. Queen are fine, but John Paul Jones, come on!
One of them's from Oatby. Yeah.
What? One of Queen?
Yeah. The bassist.
Oh, the one who lives in obscurity.
Yeah, yes.
The one who can go down to his local Asda and be completely fine.
Nearby Manners School, you know.
Absolutely, yeah. Brabazon swimming pool.
Just going back to the length and the runtime. I have a feeling that because this is a biopic about a musician specifically, that means you're playing in a lot more kind of songs. Maybe not in their entirety, but because you've got a certain amount of music in there, then that A, kind of pads out the runtime a fair amount. And then also, because it's a song and you want to go from A to B throughout, it doesn't feel like it's adding to the runtime at the same time, if you know what I mean.
I guess so.
Like, say, compare this to Ali.
Right.
Because you can potentially say, well, that could get padded out with a few boxing bouts.
Yeah.
And again, to an extent, there's a similarity, but there's a lot of acting going on in there. And when it's like constant acting for like 2.5 hours, then some people will feel the length. And again, you brought up Oppenheimer, because that film's, you know, 3 hours plus.
And, there's no musical montage in there.
And there's no biopic there, but, there is a biopic, but there's no music or, you know, boxing. But it's...
agreed, but because it's the story of Ray Charles, an important musician, the music is hugely important, and there are some pieces of music that, you know, equate particularly to certain parts of his career, and they do well to kind of have the music. If there was a lot less music in this biopic of Ray Charles, you'd feel shortchanged. Like I say, the drawback for me with the music was the fact that, and I again understand completely why they did it, but you don't get to hear Jamie Foxx do a lot of singing. They've decided to go with Ray Charles's voice because, you know, it makes sense. But again, it just stops you being able to be completely immersed in his version of Ray Charles. I felt like Jamie Foxx did so much right, but they took things away.
Well,
and we know that Jamie Foxx can sing because he has released music.
Yes. He is a very prominent musician. So actually, on that point then, so would you have preferred them to have done a kind of Walk the Line style?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Okay. Interesting.
I mean, even if... Yeah. I mean, I don't know why they didn't. I mean, I guess I can, but it seems silly.
I mean, they were...
You know, if you're doing a biopic of someone and they're letting him, you know, be the guy, let him be the guy and sing it as well. Obviously, it didn't matter too much to his Oscar appearance, or his Oscar win, rather.
No.
But I don't know.
I wonder, because it might be Cart Before the Horse, because Walk the Line came out a year after. And perhaps there was the conscious choice of, rather than mime, then just rearrange the pitch or the setting so that Whacking Bottom can, you know, sing Johnny Cash as best he can. And then...
And do a pretty good job with it.
Reese Witherspoon gets the Oscar. So...
He gets to go on and star with Lady Gaga in a
film.
Well,
there we go. That may make it all worth it. I tell you what, the month we do Whacking Bottom... properly. it's going to be an interesting look at his career. So, as we all know...
Interesting look into the bottom.
All right, Austin Powers. so, as we've said repeatedly, it's a successful film insofar as Jamie Foxx won an Oscar for it. It was a financial success. It was made for $40 million. Dollars and came away with $124 million, so that's three times as much.
Pretty good.
And a bit more. And the reception, it wasn't universal acclaim as such. It was 79% on Rotten Tomatoes. But
is that not good on Rotten Tomatoes?
So I mean, it's 79 like a B plus or something like that. I don't know.
Okay, fine.
And but
what
did
Roger Ebert think about things though? You're talking about critical response.
I really love the Mrs. King. What does Roger Ebert think?
Roger Ebert said, "The movie would be worth seeing simply for the sound of the music and the sight of Jamie Foxx performing it. But it looks deeper and gives us a sense of the man himself is what makes it special." Ebert gave it a full 4 out of 4 stars.
Cool. That was the Robert Ebert section.
Roger Ebert
section of the show.
I mean, I could try and find someone called Robert Ebert to see if, first of all, congratulate them on their name. And then secondly, it's up there with Edward Woodward.
It's pretty good.
Robert Ebert.
Robert Ebert.
Do we want to play the Oscar game or?
Not really.
Okay, fine.
I guess the last thing I want to say about this film is, based on this film, it then fueled the song Gold Digger by Kanye West, who has by no means diminished on his returns at all.
Yeah, the past 20 years have gone really well for him since he released that song.
I mean, annoyingly, yes, they have. But
well,
recently,
reputation-wise, not so much.
No. Mm. Anyway.
Anyway.
Never mind. So, with that all done and dusted, let's move on to the pick that I chose for my bro. Mm-hmm. That being the 2009 film, Law Abiding Citizen.
Hi.
Yeah?
Hear that?
Go wash out for dinner, Pumpkinhead.
Okay, I got it.
We gotta get out of here. What are you doing? Come on.
The Shelton case, where are we?
Let's make the deal.
They killed a little girl, Nick.
Some justice is better than no justice at all.
You need to tell the husband.
No, I don't understand. With Darby's testimony, Ames will go to death row.
What?
The jury's gonna believe me.
The deal is done. I'm sorry. This is just how the justice system works.
Execution has turned into something out of a horror film.
The machine was corrupted.
Who could have done this?
I killed your friend Ames in prison, but I wanted to keep you all for myself. Your heart is beating so fast. Me too. Did you murder Clarence Darby?
He killed my wife and child.
I guess we've done it.
Counselor,
you might want to cancel your 12:30 lunch with Judge Roberts.
Hello?
You and whoever else you have helping you are gonna pay.
Now you're the one who makes deals with murderers, yeah? So I've come to make mine. Release me.
Or what?
Or I kill everyone.
We have him locked up and he's still killing people?
I found a couple of contract payments from the Department of Defense.
Tell us what we're dealing with. A spy?
Spies are a dime a dozen. Clyde has a brain, and he was the best.
If Clyde wants you dead, you're dead.
We're gonna lock the city down, put an armed cop on every corner. He's in jail because he wants to be in jail.
I'm gonna bring the whole system down on your head. It's gotta be biblical.
You will end this.
I'm just getting warmed up.
Law Abiding Citizen is a 2009 vigilante action thriller film starring Jamie Foxx and Gerard Butler.
Oh!
Apparently also co-produced. And it's the story about how a man who's had his family murdered in front of him in a very brutal way by a psychopath watches to see the guy kind of escape what he would consider to be justice, because basically the evidence isn't quite there enough to definitely send him down. So instead, a plea deal is cut so that his lackey gets more of the sentence. Da-dum-de-dum-de-dum. Now, he feels that there's been a miscarriage of justice, so 10 years after the home invasion, he takes matters into his own hands, which brings him very much into the path of the district attorney who had cut the deal with the criminal responsible. And basically, they have competing ideas of how far he should be allowed to go. And yeah. So that's Law Abiding Citizen, a film I had not seen before. Brother, this is something you've been pushing for quite a while.
Yep.
So it's fair to say it's something you've not only seen before, but seemingly quite enjoy.
Yeah, I watch it almost once a year.
Oh, wow.
I don't know why. I couldn't even put a label on when I saw it for the first time, neither. I'm going to say it's probably sometime at university or just afterwards. And I don't know what it was about the film that kind of led me to like it the first time. I think it was the, in a weird way, it's the, the relationship between Gerard Butler's character and Jamie Foxx's character, because in theory, Jamie Foxx's character is kind of the hero, but I find him to be contemptible at various points of the film. And Gerard Butler's character is meant to be the sympathetic villain, but the way that he does some of the stuff and the way they play up how awful the people who were responsible for the kind of his that the falling through the cracks of the legal system are, it kind of sort of vindicates him in a way. So I find it fascinating to watch in terms of, like, I mean, that's awful, but you can kind of see why, or that's not good, but it's being portrayed as being good. And I find myself kind of flipping allegiances almost every time I watch it. Do I sympathize with Nick more or with the other guy more? So I
Nick being Jamie Foxx.
Yes, Clarence. I keep forgetting Clarence's name because it's basically Gerard Butler.
Clyde. Clarence is the killer.
Oh, yeah, sorry, yes. Yeah, my bad. Yeah. So, yeah, I've watched it a few times. I enjoy it every time. I'm really interested to hear your thoughts about it, brother.
Right. Okay. Well, I can understand the appeal to the extent that it's quite morally grey. Certainly. I think the idea, because it was interesting, because I, by and large, reckon that technically Nick, Jamie Foxx's character, is the good guy, but he's not 100% good.
No.
He's not, his hands aren't entirely clean of the whole thing. That being said, he's got to make a stand because Clyde can't really pursue his vendetta without consequences, whereas Clyde thinks he absolutely should be able to pursue his vendetta without consequences. So, as a story, I get it. In the execution, it's kind of a... what something I would have said, something I would have characterised back in the day as a TBS Superstation kind of film.
Right.
So it was the kind of film that would come on this particular network, like, I don't know, not the Fast and the Furious, Gone in 60 Seconds.
Right.
Or Tremors, or, you know, something that isn't exactly high caliber film, like The Quick and the Dead, say. That caliber of film. I may be just throwing out movies you've never heard of.
Some of
quite
them.
Frankly. Okay, cool. But, so ostensibly, we're not talking about a network that would show high art caliber films. And I very much think this is the kind of thriller film that they would quite happily throw on. And I think for the most part, because I've only seen it the once, I'm still kind of ruminating on it, I can absolutely understand the appeal. At the same time, I don't know as to whether or not the execution comes off.
Okay.
I wonder if the film wants to have its cake and eat it by pretending it's perhaps a bit more complex and clever than it actually is.
Hmm.
Now, that notwithstanding, I would say, when I first read up on this after having seen it, apparently the roles would have been the other way around.
Oh, really?
Whereas Butler would have been Nick the prosecutor and Jamie would be the guy on a vendetta seeking vengeance.
Okay.
And I'm very glad they switched the roles around.
Absolutely.
Because I think if Clyde were a black man seeking vengeance against, I think it would add an additional element of race into it, which frankly I don't think the film needs. I think the film is much better having a streamlined focus on to what extent the justice system is fair. I think that's a much better take to I'm not saying the two men couldn't play the roles.
Do
you remember how there was a theatrical production of Frankenstein about 10 years ago?
Oh, yeah, with was it Benedict Cumberbatch and Johnny Lee Miller swapping roles?
Yes, Exactly. The two Sherlocks swapping roles between Victor Frankenstein and the creature.
Yeah.
And so, and again, I reckon, again, if the roles were to have been swapped, I reckon both men could have played them believably, but I think this is the better route to go down.
I disagree. I think it plays to their strengths really well, because the character of Clyde, not Clarence, the character of Clyde is so kind of vicious but cerebral in a way that, I mean, we've seen Jamie Foxx do kind of action stuff, but he is more kind of out and out kind of gangland style in the roles that he's done, or when we see in Django, he's more kind of less cerebral. And I really like the way that Gerard Butler plays this kind of growing, menacing guy who starts out being really clever, but just kind of abandons himself to being just kind of full of wanton destruction. Whereas Jamie Foxx does an amazing job at kind of starting off being maybe a little bit sleazy, but becoming more and more. He's never really 100% sympathetic. He kind of sticks to his kind of lawyer thing about, like, you know, these are the numbers and I wouldn't change a thing. Like, everything we did correctly. Although he maybe questions that right at the end. But I like the way that they both kind of change their role slightly. But they never kind of swap over in the kind of, in the example you gave where they're like, examine the monster and the man of Frankenstein. There isn't kind of, these aren't two people on the same, two sides of the same coin. This is one person getting more harsh in their views, one person getting more mellow in their views. But then the film, to its downfall for me, the ending always rings a little bit false for me, that they're like kind of go, and Jamie Foxx wins the end. Spoiler. But I like the way that, I mean, I wish there was a bit more of Gerard Butler kind of realising, oh, I have gone too far. Because you get him in his cell, you get him kind of having a little moment of introspection, but there's not much in the way of like a, oh, yeah, moment. But the way the film kind of escalates, I enjoy. And it starts out with a really kind of horrible thing, and you kind of on one person's side, and then the other person's a bit of a dick, and then you realise, oh, hang on a minute, how far does he want to go? And you're right in your synopsis, you said about like the extent to which he should be able to get away or to do what he wants to do. And there's even a bit kind of fairly early on where, and you never know really whether Jamie Foxx's character is putting on a bit of an act or whether he actually feels this way, when there's the first kind of confession, as it were, or the first confrontation from a prison, where he kind of turns off the cameras and says, you know, I'm a father, what you did, good for you, I would have done the same thing, or something to that end, and then flips it back to being a lawyer and whatever. And there's that moment of, like, he can see why he did it, but he then has to wrangle Jamie Foxx with the decisions he made that led up to this moment. Now, this might be completely on me, kind of reading into this film, and you're right, maybe it does think it's more clever than it is, or maybe I'm kind of thinking, yes, it is. But I don't know. Art is what you make of it. So I'm watching this film and learning all sorts and making me think all sorts about, like, revenge and, like, to what end is kind of murder justified. Let's not go into current political events the day after something horrible happened. But yeah. Now, you think, brother, I'm overthinking this film?
No, not necessarily. I would agree that I enjoy films that really make you think, particularly around issues of crime and punishment and justice. So if I refer back to my click chart, there are two films in the top 10 that very much take a very good look. It doesn't come up with any answer because I don't know if a film does have the actual answer other than, you know, moderation case by case. But the two films in question would be A Clockwork Orange, which, you know, what Malcolm McDowell does as a young one is terrible, and then his rehabilitation is also terrible. Does he deserve what happens to him? And da-dum-de-dum-de-dum.
Yeah.
And then what is just underneath Casablanca on my flick chart is a German film called M.
Right.
Which, as you well know, brother, having visited my house, I've got a canvas print of Peter Lorre.
Oh, yes. Peter Lorre.
And that print is from that film.
Right.
Where basically he is a child predator who's just abducting young children off the streets. And this is concerning both, not just the general population, but also the criminal population of, I believe it's Berlin, if memory serves. And basically, it's a race between the police trying to catch this guy and the criminals trying to catch this guy, because the criminals don't want to be lumped in with a child predator.
No, they have standards. Yes.
So, I mean, ultimately, both of them eventually get to him, and there's one kind of court, and then there's a kind of, like, populist court and things like that.
Right.
So it's all very interesting. This film, I wouldn't put in the top 10 of my flick charts.
But just to add another one to the mix, brother, before we move on from that point entirely. Is I recently watched No Country for Old Men. Have you seen that?
I actually haven't, no.
And I'm not saying that this film is anywhere near that kind of height, but that's another kind of one of, it presents a situation, it prevents criminality, and very much kind of leaves the ending without a kind of, I don't know, a convenient or satisfying ending. You kind of take what you can from it and kind of walk away from it, feeling just a little bit kind of sad or having learnt something or making you think about, you know, policing or the law in a lawless age or in a lawless situation or where there is kind of greyness. And I don't know, maybe I'm picking up on a trope of something that I enjoy. The kind of, I might have to watch this film, M.
A vein of films that you'd be interested in pursuing further.
Maybe. I'll tell you what, you watch No Country for Old Men and I'll watch M. And then we can compare this to Law Abiding Citizen, the film that struck this in both of us.
Sure. As if I don't have enough things to watch. Okay. Right, okay, fine. It's a deal. So it's an interesting kind of cat and mouse kind of thing. It goes to Stavros's favourite trope of someone be wanting to get caught and masterminding things from prison.
He wanted to get caught.
And so obviously this means that quite a few people in the supporting cast come a cropper. The supporting cast does feature a former Haar subject.
Viola Davis.
Indeed.
And I didn't mention her in the episode.
She is, yes, you did. That's one of the reasons this film came up.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, she's the mayor. and then you've also got Cole Meaney.
Just Zach Patch,
yes. I mean, he's better known from his time in 90s Star Trek, but yes, he is in Alan Partridge, Alpha Papa as well. And then I also recognised Leslie Bibb, who was Nick's assistant.
Yes.
And I believe the actress playing his wife, Regina Hall, was she in
Ray? I don't know if she was. I know that she co-hosted the Oscars last year.
Oh, okay.
With obviously overshadowed by the slap heard around the world.
Yes, very much.
I think
so.
She's kind of more largely known for playing a recurring role in the Scary Movie franchise.
That is correct. That is correct. Yes, and she's done this and that here and there.
Good for her.
Good for her indeed. I mean, is there any kind of particular, without wanting to spoil the film too much, is there any kind of scene within the film that perhaps encapsulates what you enjoy the most about this? Why you keep coming back to it, essentially?
The horrendous torture of a murderer. I like the face-to-face confrontations between Nick and Clyde. At the high points for me, especially just outside the prison, where they kind of take him out of the cell so they can have a conversation without kind of the watchful eyes or videotape or whatever. And he has the line about, oh, I'm not finished. No way. I'm bringing the whole corrupt temple down on your head. It's going to be biblical. I think that is possibly my favorite Gerard Butler moment. And that includes, this is Sparta, kicking into a hole. Just because it's a really good encapsulation of someone who is just completely driven to do what he set out to do, feels completely morally in the right, and just enjoying the torture that it's bringing Jamie Foxx, who, bless him, I think Jamie Foxx in this film is amazing. And I don't put that lightly. I know I've said about, like, the film makes you want to just love Jamie Foxx all the way through, but whatever. But I think Jamie Foxx does an amazing job as this very, very confident guy who's amazing at what he does. Within the first, like, 2 or 3 minutes, his character's established as, like, the best guy, even though he's not got that job role yet. But he also is nuanced enough to kind of go, at some point later on. And it's interesting to kind of see his views change as the film progresses.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's a less kind of showy role, is the main thing. So this is... So obviously this is post-Ray, and then he's also done... I mean, we'll rattle off films towards the end, but by this point, he's very established. He's done Dreamgirls... he's done Miami Vice and such like. So he's been in a lot of big films, and then this is a kind of, again, it's a vigilante thriller, so it's not one that's going to be troubling the Oscars, but it, what it does force him to do, especially because he isn't playing the kind of man pursuing a vendetta, he has to act a lot more straight, really, whilst also getting over the fact that he is not exactly completely morally upright. It's the kind of thing that, you know, were it a different franchise, he'd wake up finding himself in a jigsaw trap or something like that. I mean, not a million miles away, but obviously less gore. Not no gore, just less gore. I don't have that much more to say about it, really.
Well, what about your favourite kind of action set pieces or things that you kind of appreciated about the film above the acting?
I think what I found the most interesting part was when Clyde is in the dock representing himself.
Right.
For his bail hearing.
Oh, yes, especially, the lawyer part.
Especially because, as you well know, I am a big fan of being a lawyer. Yeah, exactly. So it's just the case that the idea is it looks like he's going to cut a deal and he represents himself and the judge is persuaded by his argument. And then Clyde turns that around on the judge saying, you what? What I told you was horseshit. I could be a criminal.
Yeah.
So he gets banged up anyway because of contempt.
But he wanted to get caught.
But that's the thing. But
he was in his plans. So that's
what I kind of like about it,
yeah,
is that he, in that moment, had the power to go free. He chose not to, in part to make a point to justify what he was about to do without saying what he was going to do. Because technically it could have just finished with him, gaining his revenge on the two criminals who destroyed his family. But he then decided, no, we need to push it a bit further, really. But then people who, you know, weren't implicated, don't even have any particular hand in what happened to him, they also get caught up in the crossfire, such as, you know, his cellmate. What did the cellmate ever do that involved, you know, killing his family?
I don't know, but he was a means to an end, and he'd obviously
He was. Yeah. He was. So it's obviously it's not the case that Clyde's some kind of white knight.
And, no.
You know,
and that's possibly the first point in the film that you kind of go, oh, it's kind of where the fun stops. You've seen him torture a murderer. And you've seen him kind of...
Oh, I don't think it starts on a very fun setting.
No. But he's doing it to, like, someone who is outright deserving of some kind of comeuppance. Now, he goes yes. way above board, and you kind of go, here we go! And you can then, there in that scene there is a cellmate, and you don't know anything about the cellmate. He's a bit kind of rough-looking and a bit kind of violent or confrontational. You don't know anything about it. Something then happens, and... there's a kind of moment where Clyde looks conflicted, sort of, but then kind of revels in what he's done. And I like to think that was a deliberate choice of them to kind of go, ooh, how do we feel about this then? Because that's just happened. And, okay, well, I guess he was in jail, so must have been a baddie. And then it kind of continues from there. I just like that the slow moral erosion. Fade. Yes. How things kind of change just ever so slightly, and it starts with this is a horrible thing happened to a horrible person. Yeah. This is a horrible thing happened to someone who's probably horrible. Yeah. This is a bad thing that happens to someone who's bad. As in like a sort of criminal lawyer kind of guy. Okay. And then it just kind of the victims become more innocent. The crimes don't change, and I guess it's again, is this me reading into it? Are they making a kind of a point of, like, you know, do we all deserve to be treated exactly the same? Because some people get blown up, and do they have anything to do with it? Like you say, I don't know, probably not, but they're part of the system, they are kind of part of the problem as Clyde sees it, and therefore they suffer maybe less horrendously than, say, the main murderer, but still. Bad way to go, bro.
I mean, as much as I've made it sound like I didn't like it, I will be rewatching this one.
Oh, okay.
Because I do want to kind of go over it again just to see, you know, is it more clever than I'm giving it credit for? You know, is it what you have just described?
Well, I don't know.
Or is it just the case that the material is being elevated by two very charismatic lead actors? Mm. And then I should probably also give some props to the director, F. Gary Gray, who's an interesting director because he started off doing music videos. Like for some of the songs that feature in GTA San Andreas,
nice.
Like Ice Cube's "Today Was a Good Day," ooh-wah! and other things. So there's, and like his very first film was the buddy comedy that stars Ice Cube and Chris Tucker called Friday.
Nice.
Which, that's where that meme of the dam with the kind of, like, necks kind of going back suddenly.
Yeah, I know.
That's where that film's from. Nice. And then he's a variable film career. He did the remake of The Italian Job with Mark Wahlberg,
nice.
Which is terrible.
Not nice.
But he did, I suppose, because he had some insight. He was the director of Straight Outta Compton.
Okay. Fine.
And he's then done The Fate of the Furious, the Chris Hemsworth Men in Black, and most recently he did a film last year called Lift.
Called what?
Starring Lift.
Oh,
starring
Lift.
Kevin Hart.
Oh, okay. Fine. Yeah. I mean, I looked into the writer of this film, Kurt Wimmer. Mainly a writer. He did his first credit in Wikipedia is he directed a film called One Tough Bastard. but that's by the by. His first
starring
major...
Rick Moranis.
His first writing credit is for the remake of The Thomas Crown Affair with James Bond's When You're Gone, Pierce Brosnan. Then Equilibrium.
Did he direct that as well?
He did indeed.
Yeah, I thought the name rang a bell.
Yeah. So, you know, it's... I this is a kind of a sleeper thing for me. And, you're right. I you've made me think now about, like, am I projecting too much onto this film, or is there a lot of subtext to it, or is the subtext kind of a bit less? I don't know, but I keep coming back to it.
I tell you what, brother, you know who you sound like.
Go on.
Roger Ebert.
Oh God.
Oh, you really love him, Mrs. King. What does Roger Ebert think?
Who said, Law Abiding Citizen is the kind of movie you will like more at the time than in retrospect.
No.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, you don't sound anything
no,
like
No, that's
Roger.
The opposite of me.
Pandy, the opposite of Roger Ebert.
I've
been saying that for years. Still, there's something to be said for a movie you will like well enough at the time. And then rated it 3 out of 4 stars.
What?
So, there you go. But by and large, it got 26% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, is that why you're down on it? I get it.
No, I don't give a fuck about Rotten Tomatoes. It's just, okay. You know, it's just something I bring up just to give the audience an idea of what the critical reception was.
Well, I'll bring you another statistic then, brother.
Okay, then.
Budget of $53 million, made $127.9 million.
Oh, yeah, it wasn't a failure
so
by any means.
Doubled and then some its budget. Mm. And there was going to be a sequel, and then it didn't happen.
I don't see how a sequel could work.
Well, not with the same
given
characters,
how the
no,
film ends. Yeah. Well, there we go.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, well, that was Law Abiding Citizen.
We've been light on feedback recently, brother, and I understand completely.
That is our fault, though.
So, it's completely our fault. I completely understand. But if you've seen Law Abiding Citizen, I really, really, really want to hear your thought. Even if it's just a kind of, yeah, it was all right. That's fine. If you think there's more to it, yeah, give us more to it. It could be a Facebook message to our Facebook page. It could be an email to hey@earth-2.net. But it'll be great to have some kind of yardstick on this one, because I legitimately am not sure whether I have a good taste or not.
Righty-o. Well, with that being said, we move on to our main event of the podcast. And this is Jamie Foxx's starring role in a Quentin Tarantino film,
ooh,
which is Django Unchained.
There ain't no grace can hold my body down. There ain't no grace can hold my body down.
Good cold evening, gentlemen. Amongst your inventory, I've been led to believe is a specimen I'm keen to acquire.
When I hear the trumpet sound...
What's your name?
I'm on a ride right out of the ground.
Django. Then you're exactly the one I'm looking for.
Hey, stop talking to him.
Calm down. I'm simply a customer trying to conduct a transaction.
Last chance, fancy pants.
Oh, very well.
Know what a bounty hunter is?
You kill people, and they give you a reward.
Better they are, bigger the reward.
I need your help. I'm looking for the Brittle Brothers. However, I don't know what they look like, but you do. Don't you?
They caught my wife, and they sold her, but I don't know who to.
That means we visit every plantation until we find them.
Once a final Brittle Brother lies dead in the dust, I agree to give you your freedom. And I'll take you to rescue your wife.
Where are we going?
Yes!
Gentlemen, you had my curiosity, but now you have my attention. How do you like the bounty hunting business?
Kill white folks and they pay you for it? What's not to like? I like the way you die, boy.
He is a rambunctious sword, ain't he?
What's your name?
Django.
The D is silent.
Django Unchained is a 2012 Quentin Tarantino Western action film starring Jamie Foxx, Christoph Waltz, him that there Leonardo DiCaprio, Samuel L. Jackson, and lots of other people, including Walton Goggins. And it's the story of a slave who is bought by Christoph Waltz's character, who needs him to track down two particular people because he is a bounty hunter, and Django is somebody who knows who they look like, and without his assistance he will not be able to collect on the bounty. And in doing so, they realise that Django is actually quite suited to it. He is trained up and becomes a bounty hunter in his own right during slavery-ridden 19th century Texas America, Southern America.
Mississippi.
Yes. That's also Texas. But there you go. It's a film that I had not seen before.
What?
I know. And I don't quite know for why, because I know lots of people that I love and admire and respect really like this film, but for whatever reason, I just never had got round to watching it. Wow. So this was my first watching of this film. What is your history with watching the film Django Unchained?
I don't think I saw it at the cinema, but I definitely saw it very soon after it was released.
Okay.
Because I'd kind of got back into Tarantino by the time of 2012, so I moved up to Newcastle 2009, and I got Inglourious Basterds as a present for my birthday in 2010 on DVD.
Lovely.
From the Agers, as it were.
Oh, how lovely.
This kind of marks the kind of beginning of the kind of latter era of Tarantino, I'd say. After, if you think that, like, Grindhouse is his kind of demarcation from all the stuff he was doing in the 90s, and like there's a clear break with that and Kill Bill from, you know, him doing a double feature and then getting into more kind of focused projects. And I think Inglourious Basterds is kind of particularly important because it very much launched Christoph Waltz,
yes,
as an actor.
A global actor.
A global actor. And yes, because he is an Austrian actor. Well, I think I read an interview. It's like, yeah, I was born in Austria, but yeah. I consider myself more German, really. And I put the two films basically on a par, really.
Okay.
I do need to rewatch Bastards at some point because I think if I were to ever tempt you back to the flick chart for him, brother, it would... It would be to do a Tarantino ranking.
Okay.
Because we kind of did that when we covered Kill Bill in year one of the podcast.
Yeah, I guess so.
And there's been a few, not many, but a few more films since then. So this film is interesting insofar as it is recognisably a Tarantino film, but it is something that's kind of out of his comfort zone. Because,
okay.
I mean, Bastards was, I think, the first one that was kind of set, like, properly way back in history. And here, he's going even further back and exploring, how can I marry my exploitation film tendencies to the West?
Mm.
And how would I want to do it? And the result is Django Unchained. And also...
Indeed.
Now that I've made Christoph Waltz, how do I crowbar him into it, believably?
People love that guy. I'll use him again.
That's a bit, I'm not criticising his inclusion whatsoever.
No.
But
no.
What I would say is that it was clearly whatever kind of commercial revival he got from Inglourious Basterds, he took on with this film. And in Jamie Foxx, I feel like it's a very different role for him to play, but we'll go into that later on. This being your first viewing, brother, and again, that took me by complete surprise. I just assumed you had seen it. What were your first impressions of Django Unchained?
I mean, I really liked it. It's okay, yeah. It's a Tarantino film. Therefore, you come into it knowing there's going to be a certain kind of, I don't know, a certain mark of the auteur, the director, the artist, yes, the creator. And it falls very much within the purview of what he does in lots of his other films, especially the post-Grindhouse era. There are absolutely definitive links between, stylistically, Inglourious Basterds and Kill Bill. And therefore I kind of sat down and kind of just enjoyed the ride, as it were, just to see how he was going to tell this wacky tale. And it's a film that you can't think too much about. Again, similar to some of his other films, it's just a case of, yeah, it's Tarantino, so there's going to be a lot of artistic license used in order to tell a story that he wants to tell, for better or worse, and we'll come on to that a little bit later on. But from an initial I've seen it now point of view, and having some time to ruminate on it, it's a film that I really enjoyed. Lots of awesome action set pieces. The soundtrack really stood out to me in this one, and it's something that Tarantino, we talk about a lot in terms of his style and whatever, and his soundtracks always seem to kind of push through in terms of whether the period warrants that music or matches the period or matches the situation. It doesn't really matter. He uses the right song for the right time. And there are some recurring themes throughout, but I'll set my stall out there going, yeah, initial rewatch, enjoyed it. Under scrutiny, though, I'm looking forward to kind of talking through a couple of issues I have with the film.
Okay. Why don't we kick off with that, then? So what would be what you consider to be your primary kind of point?
Main point is it's a very touchy area of history.
Yes.
The kind of the 19th century kind of problems between the South and black people. And
problems, yes.
I mean, to put it extremely mildly. I obviously have little to no dog in the fight in terms of my knowledge of the situation, but I might feel a little bit, or I kind of feel a little bit uneasy with the idea of Quentin Tarantino going, I want to make a Western. Hang on a minute, slavery. Here we go. And like, just going for it. Now, I'm not sure, and I've not looked too far into links to real life and real history. Obviously, he kind of very much leaves a lot of history at the door, but obviously needs something to hang his film on, does old Tarantino. And whether it's a true depiction of, I mean, obviously there's a lot of stupid things happening here, there and everywhere, but whether a lot of it is grounded in the real life experience of slaves and slave owners and the people who held the power and did not have the power at that time, it's kind of moot. But it smacks of a guy going, I'm going to tell this story without having any kind of, or little, I don't want to say respect, because I'm sure he does show respect and did show respect, but the way he throws the story into the situation, and you're opening yourself up to a lot of criticism in terms of realism, and even whether it's kind of a good thing to, I'm struggling for the phrase, it's not make light of, but he's telling a story in a situation where there would be lots of links to trauma, generational trauma, and yeah. I don't think Tarantino has the most sensitive hands. But yeah, I guess that's only when you sit down and kind of start to go, right, well, is it right to enjoy this film, I wonder? I don't want to be all hand-wringing about it, but it's inextricably linked to a certain subject matter, and on closer inspection, how does he do? But I've served the ball. Catch.
Received. Time to volley. So obviously I think in the first instance historical inaccuracy is going to be a thing, and you know, I'd be a hypocrite to say nah, it's fine if you consider my somewhat memorable rant when we would cover the Mel Gibson film Braveheart.
Yes, indeed.
Yes. So what I would probably say the biggest thing about the film that is really historically inaccurate insofar as there isn't a proper established legacy about it is the Mandingo fighting.
Oh, so really?
The bit where we see Leonardo DiCaprio's character for the first time.
Yeah.
That kind of thing wasn't a thing.
Jesus.
Or, at the very least, it wasn't something that was in history books, in records.
It's that's like, a big crux of the film.
It's a big crux of the film, certainly.
Because the whole point is, I want to buy this slave. Oh, and chuck the old girl in as well. She might be my wife.
Now, sure. Now, the slave trading, that isn't an issue. The pretext of...
I'd just like you to just consider the sentence you just said. Because out of context, it's pretty awful.
Say it back to me, brother.
The slave trading is not an issue.
It is not historically debated. I think it's a pretty well-known fact.
Yes, I know, but it's just, yes. I'm being silly. Yeah, anyway, well, do carry on.
My brother's a racist. But I think moreover, I mean, so that's the, I mean, you get a certain amount of artistic license, but that is the biggest thing that the film kind of invents for the purposes of the story. And I think more broadly, your point about Tarantino being the guy to put this film together, that was controversial at the time. As you'd probably expect.
I think because he's a white dude deciding, I'm going to tell the story.
Yeah, well, it's not even just the fact that he's a white dude. It's the fact he's Quentin Tarantino. A man who lacks, shall we say, subtlety.
Oh, I've only had a body of work that would demonstrate that.
Now, I refer to the consistent, continual use of the N-word.
Oh, God, it's so much.
Now, with regards to that, it is very likely to be historically accurate that the N-word was used very liberally, shall we say, in the 19th century, particularly around the South.
Mm.
So it's not so much that issue, it's just like, should Quentin Tarantino be writing that into the script as much as he is? Because it's going to rub some people up the wrong way. And indeed, it did. Would it surprise you, brother?
Right.
And now, we've covered a film of his before. We've not covered a lot of his oeuvre, but you're aware of the prominent African-American director Spike Lee.
I am indeed, yes.
Yes, with his zoot suit in Malcolm X.
Yeah, of course.
Yes. He was not best pleased.
Oh, really?
No. Which puts the mutual friend of the two directors, Samuel L. Jackson, in a bit of a compromising position.
I can imagine, because he says it a lot, and he's probably all right to do so. But
he is, and he's going to have his own opinion about it. And he was more on, perhaps not surprisingly, in that he is a featured actor and character in this film.
No. It's almost as if Tarantino likes to use old favourite actors of his.
Well, that's the thing that Tarantino very much helped him establish himself as a major Hollywood player.
Yes, indeed.
But he did say that, you know, Tarantino, you know, that he had no issue with Tarantino doing it. And also, he pointed out the slight hypocrisy, not necessarily directing this at Spike Lee, but the fact that Django Unchained came out the year before the film 12 Years a Slave.
Okay.
So this wasn't a contemporary quote at the time, but Jackson did say that because 12 Years a Slave was helmed by the black director Steve McQueen,
indeed,
who's an artist and respected for making art films, that 12 Years a Slave is held in higher esteem than Django. And goes on to say that 12 Years a Slave, yeah, that's a blaxploitation movie. So, again, as a white British man, I have nothing to rebut his opinion of 12 Years a Slave, especially because I haven't seen 12 Years a Slave.
Well,
I would say that it is fair that, you know, slavery is a very evocative, emotive subject to begin with.
Yeah.
And therefore, whether there is a right or a wrong telling of it, it isn't for me to say, certainly. But if you don't have a degree of the dehumanization of slavery, then you're not telling the story properly.
I mean, he's kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. Because if he didn't include the language of the day, he would be accused of not making it, you know, the proper experience. He has done, and now he's being hauled over the coals for doing so. And it's, again, it kind of weighs into the point of, was it really the right film to do? But then you can't deny it's a fun film. So it's it kind of rankles on a few levels about, like, should you enjoy yourself? Yes, you should enjoy yourself. But also bear in mind this, that, and the other. It's, I don't like that thought. I'd rather just be able to watch something and go, yeah, that's this.
I think he's also kind of hauled over the coals, as it were, just because he perhaps overemphasizes the use of the N-word. Like,
I mean, I have no frame of reference, so
perhaps,
I don't...
As in, perhaps he just uses it too much, is what I'm saying.
Oh, he uses it a lot. So I guess the question is, how much is too much? In order to kind of...
Blazing Saddles? You know, I mean, that uses it. But, yes. I mean, and that's a completely different type of film.
Yeah.
But with regards to this, it's more... And I think where Jackson is potentially being a bit too kind to Tarantino... is that the likely violence in 12 Years a Slave is likely to have been at least tangentially realistic.
Right.
The violence in this film, because it's Quentin Tarantino, is absurdly over the top.
Because it's Quentin Tarantino.
Because it's... And don't get me wrong. I mean, the over-the-top violence is by and large happening to the villains of the piece. But...
Yeah.
At the same time, you know, there is a legitimate argument that Tarantino goes a bit too far on more than one level in this film. That is not to say that doesn't make it entertaining. In fact, you could argue in reverse that the excess is what kind of brings out the entertainment value in what's going on as a kind of light relief. To say, yeah, that person deserved to die, or that horse deserved to die, or what have you.
Well, because they spend a lot of the film, in a similar way that Quentin Tarantino does, they spend a lot of the time kind of building up and building up and building up and building up, so that when there is those moments of relief, you go, yeah, that guy got their comeuppance, or wow, well done, the bride, you did that. So it's, I mean... I think this film would fall to pieces completely with this kind of scrutiny if it wasn't for the central performances and the way it was directed.
Yes.
And we're talking about Jamie Foxx this episode. And
sure
he's great in this film.
He is.
I think the action chops, the actual like emotion he's got to portray, because he's not just an out-and-out badass. He is a troubled guy who is... in love and missing his wife and worried about her, but also got righteous fury and anger. He's kind of settling into his kind of destiny as a bounty hunter. And he does that without changing too much of his face. It's all the kind of nuances that we've seen from that both the other films we've covered in this episode rolled into an action version, which goes to show just how versatile this man Fox is.
I mean, he goes on one hell of an arc, certainly, because he's got to go from an illiterate slave whose wife is very much more the intelligent one of the two. Now, he's got his own smarts and such like, but he's kind of quietly, but he's not a verbose character.
No.
And he has to be brought out of his shell to realise his potential by Waltz's Dr. King Schultz. Character, who we will get to in a second. But I think he has to undergo this journey, to which you see the very defined three acts of the film. You've got from the kind of the montage of learning of Django from his relationship with Schultz. The second act, which is to do with all of Leonardo DiCaprio's scenes within the film. And then once you've lost a fair few major characters, you've got the showdown between Django and what is arguably the main big bad of the film, which is the, I suppose, Uncle Tom character that is played by Samuel L. Jackson.
Mm.
So I think it's... Because it's not a short film exactly, it's 2 hours 45 minutes, it is worth seeing the fact that he doesn't just go from A to B over the course of a Trey Parker montage, but it is the fact that you've got to get to a point that when you do lose certain characters in the film, you've got to be invested enough to keep on going right through the final act. To see how the film plays out. So, in that way, it is a success. Again, Jamie Foxx is the central through line throughout the film, and really very good. Very impressed by him.
Absolutely.
The one thing about the plot, before we go into the other characters, the one thing that I've always had a question about that's not been entirely narratively satisfying to me is that the third act begins with Django completely at Stephen's mercy.
Right.
And Stephen being the Samuel L. Jackson character, to those who haven't seen it.
Mm-hmm.
He's being hung upside down, naked, and Stephen's like saying, "Oh, I'm going to castrate you here. Ha ha ha. Ah, just playing. I'm going to send you down the mines." And I'm just like, kill him. that's what you want to do. It's not like you're going to visit him down the mines and taunt him.
I mean,
you've gone all Bond villain there. I'm just going, or Dr. Evil. I'm just going to assume everything went to plan.
Going to get some shocks with laser beams on there.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I think it speaks potentially towards the character that, what's the character's name? Sam.
Stephen.
There you go. Wrong S. Yeah.
Sam's his Christian name.
Oh, of course. Silly me.
Yes. we did an episode on him, brother.
Oh, yeah. He's got an L as a middle name. What does that L stand for? Anyway, it's, it maybe
Leroy
speaks...
Jackson. It is actually Leroy. Sorry.
It speaks towards, like, the character's dismissal of his fellow black man, where he believes that, you know, I'm top dog here, you're just this, and therefore, you know, you can't do this, that, and the other because you're black. Mm. You're right, it does kind of ring true, but I guess there's a kind of an element of him disregarding at his own, like, downfall, this person who, by this point, has proved himself to be, like, smarter than the average bear. So yeah, it's a stupid decision. You're absolutely right. I guess there is a kind of justification for it, but yeah.
I just to be clear, I don't think the scene in and of itself is bad. I think it's wonderfully well acted. This is the kind of scene that Tarantino would write with Jackson in mind.
Yeah.
Knowing that he's going to pull it up, visualizing exactly how it's going to go.
Yeah.
And to that end, I don't have a problem with the scene. It's more, as a story beat, it doesn't particularly compute. I think what then kind of enhances the issue I've got with it, it then cuts to the Quentin Tarantino cameo of the film. And believe me, now, it's not quite as long as his cameo in Pulp Fiction, say.
Yeah.
But it's still like, oh, there he is. I'm out of the film now. Oh, he's been tricked. And oh, he's going back. Okay. Right. What was and the also, point of that?
Also, Michael Parks is there too.
Why couldn't they have a mine on the Candyland premises or something.
I mean, it's. I think you're right. The third act is the least engaging for me, which is sad because you know,
despite a truly epic action sequence at the end,
absolutely. But it is kind of undone by the steps taken to get there, and I understand why they've done it in terms of proving that Django isn't just like a sidekick. He can do all this stuff on his own. He's outsmarted people. He's gone from like absolutely nothing and outsmarted everybody to then taking what's his. But definitely could have been done better. But maybe that speaks to the strengths of, you know, the first two acts.
Sure. But I will say, and just because it seems like the obvious point to talk about his character now, that Samuel Jackson as Stephen is excellent, because again, it's not like Jackson was a particularly young man during the making of this film, but he was even older. He was playing it even older than he actually was.
Right.
And, you know, the first time you see him, he is staring daggers through Django just to have the temerity to ride a horse.
Yeah.
And, and even then, you know, you've got Calvin Candy, who's there, like, demonstrating all the charm, especially given that there was a fairly unpleasant incident on the way up to the house itself. But he's trying to keep everything calm. And then, as soon as they get to the house, you've got Stephen right there. It's like, who the hell is this? And, you know, Candy just having to put him in his place. So he is playing it old, and he does. I mean, Stephen even has a kind of doddery act when he's got a kind of interplay with Candy as well, which is really good fun. I mean, they don't. I was about to say they don't make a lot of it, but that's not completely true, because when Stephen is filling in on Candy on what the potential scheme is that's going on, the rug's seemingly being pulled from under him, he's sitting down like in a chair softly and just thinking, look, this is what has happened, and he's deduced everything. And at that point Candy's just like, this and this is why he is the head of the household, you know. Like, Not only because he has extreme loyalty to Candy, but at the same time, Candy doesn't treat him as a fool. I mean, he clearly thinks less of him because he's black, but the fact is, there's a clear bond between the two. Perhaps the bond is the thing that isn't made out as much as perhaps it ought to, just to demonstrate the undertones of maliciousness of the Stephen character. I suppose that more comes out with his treatment of Broomhilda. But, yeah, I think as a presence, it's like, if you're going to crowbar Jackson into a film, again, I've said this about Waltz as well. It's unfair to use the term crowbar. But if you're going to find a role for him, they're making him the low-key actual villain of the entire film.
The final boss.
Exactly. He's a character who's handled incredibly well.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. Crowbar is the wrong verb, but what he has decided to do, Tarantino, is to go, I'm going to have this person, this person, this person in my film, and because they're them, I will write this, which we've seen him do in pretty much every film he's ever done since he got a big name for himself.
Have you seen the popular meme going around? Not meme, but around social media, it's very often floated. Tarantino's dream cast list for Pulp Fiction.
No.
And he basically got like 90% of his first choices in the roles that he had in mind.
Nice.
Yeah.
Oh, good man. And then
all the kind of alternate actors that he'd consider in their stead if the first choice wasn't available.
Yeah, No, I get that. I get
next time I see it, I'll forward it to you.
Ping it across. Yeah. I want to see it. Yeah. So can we talk briefly about Leonardo DiCaprio?
Briefly or at length. You know, I'm fine.
Because I'm conflicted about his character. Because, like, I am still on the fence about whether Leonardo DiCaprio is actually a good actor or not.
Okay. All right, Christian. guess who's visited the UK recently?
Poisoned me with his... Yes, the wonderful Christian Honoré took a pilgrimage to Britain. Hung out in Newcastle with you and hung out in Northampton with me and fam. We took him for a pub dinner. It was lovely. It's nice to see him. And he brought some delicious American candy. I think it was American. I don't know. He bought some M&M brittle, which is very nice. Anyway, that's by the by. So me and Christian agree. Leonardo DiCaprio's quality is questionable. That's not fair. But what I did like about him in this film was he was threatening all the way through. And he was kind of made out to be this guy who's very changeable in his opinions. You know, he doesn't really give a toss until he does. And you definitely got that with his character in this film. In terms of at the beginning, yeah, he's there. He kind of gives them a bit of a nod. And then as soon as there's the quotable line of, "Now you have my attention."
Yes.
And he's got his kind of beautiful southern drawl dripping all over everything that he says. Which is pretty good, but I don't know. I think this is one of his stronger roles for me. But he did seem a bit arch, but I guess it fits within the grand scheme of the theming of the film and the way it feels. So I don't know. I'll give him a pass for this one.
Imagine an arch character in a Tarantino film. Especially one who's a slaver.
But I think the problem is it's Leonardo DiCaprio, and there he is. And
well, that's the thing, but it's interesting, because this is the first time that Tarantino and DiCaprio worked together.
Right.
And they've gone on to work together since then. I mean, DiCaprio has this way of charming his way and working with very big-time directors. It's like he kind of succeeded De Niro as Scorsese's kind of muse, with regards to Scorsese films. And I mean, just 2 years before this, he worked with Christopher Nolan with regard to Inception.
Indeed. Now that's a good film.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be very interesting when we do a DiCaprio month, because I think we should.
I think we should. It's one of the biggest names on the planet.
Absolutely. So it'll be interesting to kind of go into what we think of him as an actor on the whole. I think here he works very well. I mean, particularly because, I mean, he doesn't get introduced until an hour into the film, because there'd be no point, frankly. You need to build up Django's story before you need to build up the reason why he'd cross paths with Calvin Candy. And to that end, I think DiCaprio plays Candy very well. I mean, it's not quite as arch as, I don't know, Kenneth Branagh in Wild Wild West. But
I wonder if they would, like, fit really well next to each other.
Maybe.
I'll do supercuts between Loveless and Candy.
Who knows? But again, I think he works very well as the kind of guy that can be flattered by Schultz, and then also the guy who has the interplay with Stephen. And then he's got the other kind of southern charm with his sister, and then his obvious disregard or lack of empathy for Negro people. And again, I'm thinking of the scene where you've got the kind of runaway slave up a tree who's being pursued by dogs.
Oh, yes.
And the tension that's got, which is kind of like that whole sequence and the bit before and the bit after. That's the main bit where you've got Walton Goggins.
there he is with his teeth.
Again, I never watched The Shield, so I'm not huge on Walton Goggins. In so far as my exposure to him, it's like he's done more TV than he's done films. So I just haven't seen a lot of his films, but it's clear that there's there are inherently dislike likable qualities about Candy and his plantation of Candyland and everything. Oh, but Candyland, that's such a Tarantino thing.
Yeah. Isn't it?
Any more on that? Or because we haven't spoke about either Dr. Schultz or Broomhilda.
Well, Broomhilda, there's not a huge amount to go on,
that's
sadly.
Fair.
I mean, she's always on. She was always on his mind. And
Kerry Washington again.
Yes, yeah, we saw her earlier.
Yep.
She does a good job as sort of damsel in distress, but also conflicting emotions in that scene with Schultz, where, you know, it looks like she's going to kind of service him because that's what the Massa wants her to do.
Yep.
And then the love that comes at the end of that scene is lovely. There's not much to do really for her, but what she has got to do, she does well. Which feels unfair, but you know, this is not a film that's massive on women characters, but there you go. What there is stuff to talk about is Christoph Waltz.
Yes.
And like I said earlier, it's a case of I'm going to have Christoph Waltz in my film, so therefore I'm going to have this guy who is German just because, and here's the reason why he's here. As in, you know, don't think about it too much. He's just this guy. And okay, fine. Take that at face value. We don't need to worry too much about the history of it. I think he is an engaging character. He's definitely a likable character.
It's one of his few non-villain roles.
Yeah.
By my reckoning.
Well, kind of directly comparing against how heinous he was in Inglourious Bastards.
Heinous, but charming.
A charming.
He's still charming.
Yeah.
But he's working kind of on the side for good.
He's the nice charming rather than the evil charming. And therefore, maybe there's not a huge amount of difference between the two roles. It's been a while since I've watched Inglourious Bastards.
I'll be using my gossip for good instead of evil.
Thanks, Helen Lovejoy.
Yes.
I mean, he's a good character. He's a good kind of mentor figure. He's kind of the... the spiritual leader of Django, or kind of definitely the mentor.
Mentor, definitely.
Yeah. And kind of is the brains of the outfit until it's clear that Django is on par, if not exceeding his own kind of skills. And you know, without wanting to do too much of a spoiler, I think he's kind of... Oh, no, I don't think there's any way to not spoil that he's missed in the third act.
The way he exits the film.
The way he exits the film is noble, but you kind of, I definitely kind of missed his presence towards the end of the film.
Ties back into the third act being the weakest bit.
Maybe. I mean, it's not because he's not there, it's just... And he's kind of got to
I don't know,
go.
I feel like he kind of missed his presence. But
I definitely did.
I mean, again, as much as I thought Django going off to the mines didn't make storyline sense, I did feel that the removal of Schultz from play did make storyline sense because, you know, you've got to now have Django as his own man, doing his own thing, winning his own battles. I love Waltz in this. I think he's great.
He does very
again,
well.
It's not... Not quite Hans Lander, but how do you top that performance? So, and I will say that because Lander got Waltz an Academy Award, Dr. King Schultz got Waltz an Academy Award for
Hooray!
Best Actor as well.
Oh,
so
good.
It clearly works. clearly works to work with Quentin Tarantino if you are Christoph Waltz.
Yeah.
So I'm surprised he hasn't been in more, frankly. But there we go.
I mean, we've talked quite at length about this film, so I think we're probably in the realms of wrapping up. Though I would like to make a couple of quick points, if I may.
Sure.
Notwithstanding the Weinstein connection, but never mind.
Yes, that being stamped all over the film's problematic.
Never mind. It's... there are obviously huge ties between this film and Inglourious Basterds in terms of a story set in revisionist history, or a time of revisionist history. And ultimately, if you can kind of get past that, you might enjoy the film. If you enjoy Tarantino's other work, you'll enjoy the film.
If you like Tarantino, you'll probably like this.
And it's a well-done story. There's great action in it. I don't think there's a bad performance in there.
Jonah Hill's in this film, and even that counts against the film.
The whole sequence poking fun at the KKK members is hilarious. Yes. It has its cake and eats it too in many ways in terms of vilifying and saying slavery is bad, but in doing so, it does kind of run potentially afoul of some people's feelings. I've got a game for you, brother.
Okay.
And it's not the Oscar game.
I hope it's a short game.
Just a short one. Three films we've mentioned this review, including Django Unchained, that are all set in the Wild West at the end of the 19th century. Those films being Django Unchained, Wild Wild West, and Blazing Saddles. My question to you, brother, is, in terms of the story of the film, which is the earliest chronologically? Like, if there was like a trio of the films, which, what order would you watch them in if you wanted to watch them in chronological order?
If I were going to do them in chronological order...
As in, which is the earliest set?
Yep. So, the American Civil War had happened by the time of Wild Wild West, because that was the whole problem that Lovelace had with the protagonist.
Okay.
So... that one is going to be, at the very least, in the middle, if not at the end.
Okay.
There was still slavery in Blazing Saddles.
Mm-hmm.
And there was obviously... So, Wild Wild West would be last.
Okay.
Now, is Blazing Saddles before or after this film, which is set in 1858, because I've got Wikipedia up in front of me? I'm going to say Django came first, then Blazing Saddles, then Wild Wild West.
You are 1-3.
Oh, right, okay.
Django is the earliest. Wild West is meant to have taken place in 1869.
Right.
And Blazing Saddles is meant to have taken place in 1874. Now,
were there not slaves in Blazing Saddles?
Well, they were definitely working on the railroad. Or the Livelong Day. Dunno.
Okay, interesting.
But yeah, so that's my history game for the day.
Well, at least I got one. If I got all of them wrong, then that would be very embarrassing.
Yeah, quite.
But there we go. Yeah. Made for $100 million, box office, $426 million.
I mean, of course.
I don't think Tarantino does films that tank, so...
He's
just got that cadre... of a name.
Yeah.
As I said, Waltz won an Oscar for the film. Tarantino won for Best Original Screenplay.
Lovely.
So good for him. and then critically, again, notwithstanding the kind of racial criticism with regards to the film, 87% on Rotten Tomatoes. Mr. Ebert.
Oh, God, really?
Robert Ebert. I thought you'd made a jingle.
I had. Oh, he really loves him. This is king. What does Roger Ebert think?
The film offers one sensational sequence after another, all set around these two intriguing characters who seem opposites but share pragmatic, financial and personal issues. There's more, but this review's running long. So, you generally had a good impression of your first time watching Django, brother.
I enjoyed it. It's a well-made, fun film. If you can disassociate from a lot of the wider issues surrounding it, it's
which
fine.
Which is difficult.
which is difficult to do.
That is. Right, well, we'll drop in a clip of Django! And then we'll talk more about the life and times of Mr. Jamie Foxx.
Woohoo!
Come on now! Come on, Burley! Come on! Get you set up!
And the Lord said, the fear of ye and the dread of ye shall be on every beast of the earth.
Hey, give me that arm! You better give me that arm! You better give me that arm! Okay, she ready!
After this, we'll see if you break eggs again.
John Brill!
So Jamie Foxx, he's a foxy man. He was born in 1967, and therefore he's 57. Singing's fun and everything. And I'm singing because he's not only an actor brother, he's also a musical man as well, with his own musical career, his own albums, his own labels. You know, he's somebody who is not just a one-trick pony.
Fellow comedian as well.
Yes, of course, he's part of your comedy brethren.
He is indeed.
Yeah.
Because he joined the cast of the black ensemble comedy programme In Living Colour.
Look in my eyes! What do you see?
All right, CM Punk.
The ghost of personality.
Stop ruining wrestling. And
I hate that that song is tied up with him. It's a great song.
As do I. But In Living Colour, for those of you who don't know, I'm speaking mainly to non-Americans, it was well known for feeding and watering the Wayans brothers for a good many years. But also led to the superstardom careers of the likes of very well-known African-Americans Jim Carrey and Jennifer Lopez.
I didn't realise Jennifer Lopez
she was a dancer on the show.
Oh.
So Jamie Foxx kind of got his big break through that and then went on from there to have his own sitcom. And naturally, movie stardom would follow.
Of course.
Now, you were about to ask me when was the first time that I heard of him or saw him or something along those lines.
Yes.
I have a feeling that I wasn't aware of him really until, like, 2004. So around the time he was doing Ray, but also with Collateral, which we covered for our Tom Cruise month.
Right.
I didn't know about him in the 90s. He wasn't on my cultural radar. It's possible that, so 2004, I spent the first half in Canada, so it's possible that he was more on my radar there.
Right.
But I think
being
by the time...
North Americas.
Indeed. But I mean, by the time I was at university, I knew who he was. Whether or not I'd seen any of his films, I am looking down the list. I don't think I have seen a film of his in the cinema up until Baby Driver in 2017.
Oh
no, I would have seen Amazing Spider-Man 2.
In the cinema?
Just trying to suppress it. I was still doing the comic book thing.
Oh, vaguely. Fair enough. But, I mean, I can beat you slightly, brother.
Go on.
Because I saw him in A Million Ways to Die in the West.
Oh, okay.
Because for whatever reason, we decided to watch that for a birthday. And he had a cameo as Django, which I remember people going, "Hey!" And
right.
I didn't really kind of get it because I hadn't watched Django.
Yeah. That would be an issue.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he had minor roles in films in the 90s. His very first one was the Robin Williams film Toys, which
really?
I remember starting to watch after taping it off Channel 4 and then losing all interest because it wasn't like Aladdin.
This isn't like Aladdin!
Other films you might have heard of. The Truth About Cats and Dogs, starring former Haas subject Uma Thurman. He was also in Any Given Sunday, which is the Oliver Stone-directed football movie with Al Pacino as a coach. The first film of his that we have seen in his chronological film career is the fact he had a role in Ali.
Yes, indeed.
So we covered that for Will Smith Redux last year. And then, as I say, 2004 Collateral we've covered already. Ray we've covered in this episode. Yeah, from there, his stock is well established. And he's now in films such as, well, Stealth. But then also Jarhead, which was a Sam Mendes film. Remember Sam Mendes?
He was a thing.
He directed a couple of Bond films.
Yeah,
and, that,
and nobody's heard of him since.
That celebrated Kevin Spacey paedophile drama, American Beauty, which I can't imagine has aged well. I didn't watch it at the time.
I know.
So that was him and Jake Gyllenhaal and Peter Skarsgård. After that, The Kingdom, which is to do with being an FBI special agent. And then 2009, you have your beloved law-abiding citizen.
My heart beats.
And then he was in one of Robert Downey Jr.'s comeback movies,
okay.
The Soloist, which was nice. The year after Iron Man. So it's just like, hang on, Robert Downey Jr.'s a thing again.
He's back.
Well, well, well. they would go on to co-star again the following year in Due Date, the film that's kind of Planes, Trains and Automobiles, but isn't, and involves Zach Galifianakis.
Ah, joy.
He was also in one of those terrible A-list ensemble movies, Valentine's Day.
Ugh. Disgusting.
Have you ever seen Rio Pandy?
No, thankfully.
Yeah, he's a voice in that.
Fantastic.
And then also that year, he was in the Two Horrible Bosses movies.
Right.
And then between that, Django Unchained in 2012, White House Down.
Is that part of the Is Down franchise?
Yes, it is.
With Morgan Freeman.
I don't think Morgan Freeman's in it.
Oh.
But it's Roland Emmerich, so you know it's good.
Okay.
And he plays the President of the United States.
I'm the President.
Exactly.
Okay, cool. What am I thinking of then? What's the Morgan Freeman series where, like, he's the President and everything's going to shit?
I don't know if he did a series, but he was in a film like that for a film called Deep Impact. which also starred, was also directed by Roland Emmerich.
Oh, that might be where I'm getting.
That was when a meteor hit the Earth.
Right.
Well, he was president.
And he's the president.
Exactly. 2014, The Amazing Spider-Man 2. I did not care for that.
No, I never watched it. I never got around to it, never bothered to. I know how it ends. Yeah. I just don't care for it.
But like most things, the film was kind of rehabilitated by Spider-Man No Way Home in 2021. So,
ah, yes.
So there we go. Also,
I have just, sorry, before we move on too far, I have just quickly looked up, he was in, Morgan Freeman was in one of the Has Fallen films. He was the Speaker of the House in, I think, the first one.
Okay.
So yeah, so I'm kind of there. So if he's not in the second one, he probably died. Oh no, he's in another one. So
I think we're mixing up the Has Fallen franchise with, whether or not White House Down actually, became
oh, they are separate things. Mm. Oh, okay.
Hence the confusion.
So I'm mixing up Deep Impact with two very similar Has Fallen or Is Down or Things Are In The Shit franchises. Got ya.
I have a feeling the reason for your confusion is those kind of films were coming out roughly the same time.
Got ya.
Whereas Deep Impact was 1997.
I saw an interesting video documentary about the kind of theming of disaster movies post and pre 9/11.
Okay.
And how pre 9/11 they're all kind of hopeful, amazing, isn't everything great? Because we're gonna win. And post 9/11 they're all kind of everything's awful.
You go from Mr. President, I'd like to know what you're doing.
What are you doing? I'm an airman, Bill.
Oh, that's an old bit. whatever the hell the current stuff is. Destruction. Also, 2014, the same year as Amazing Spider-Man 2, a film we talked about for Cameron Diaz month. He was Big Daddy Stax in the Annie remake.
Oh.
We talked about because that was quote unquote Cameron Diaz's retirement film.
Oh, yes. But she's back now.
Exactly.
Thanks to Jamie Foxx. But more about that later.
Okie dokie. Then there's a relatively fallow period. I've mentioned Baby Driver. That was
indeed. Have you seen that?
I have seen that, yes, because that's Edgar Wright.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it a lot.
I wasn't as high on it as most.
I mean, you touched on something when you talked about it, that it does rely or lean very heavily on the soundtrack.
Mm.
But that is by design, so I don't see it as a problem.
I mean, it is Edgar Wright at the end of the day.
Well, it's Edgar Wright and it's somebody who's lived his life through music.
Yes, that's fair, that's fair.
Yeah.
The following year, he was Little John in the Taron Egerton Robin Hood movie, the one that I haven't seen. From the people who kind of brought you Kingsman.
Oh, okay.
That might be unfair. It's just Taron Egerton's involved, I just assume.
And that's all he can do, because he's Taron Egerton.
Sure. And then, again, I know you don't like me going over everything. The only thing
I... Well, you're doing it, so you may as well carry
I'm
on.
Not. I'm missing things out. he voiced a character in Soul, the Disney Pixar movie.
I've seen that.
Is it any good?
It's kind of fallen into the Pixar trap of, yeah, it's very well animated and they're doing very well, but it's just not as fun as the other films used to be. It's got Kristen Schaal as a major thing. Has it? Kristen Schaal? I don't know. It's got Graham Norton as a main cast member. That's a weird juxtaposition.
Gosh. Okay. Yeah. Did not see that one coming.
I know. Oh, no, wasn't Kristen Schaal, it's Tina Fey, excuse me.
Easily confusable.
Big difference.
In that case, I'll hand the rest of it over to you, brother. What of the remaining films, none of which I recognise, would you highlight for attention?
I mean, you've already mentioned Spider-Man No Way Home, which kind of got him to reprise and in some ways elevate, I gather, his performance in Amazing Spider-Man 2. Of the other ones, I mean, this is around the time that he had a stroke, had a bit of a problematic health episode.
Yes, indeed.
So he did have a stroke in 2023, but there were a few roles of his that came out, so obviously kind of pre-filmed. There's some voice acting roles. He was in an interesting looking film called They Cloned Tyrone, which is a science fiction comedy film, which just from the poster looks quite interesting. And he was also in a film alongside Tommy Lee Jones.
Ooh.
Who I'm as surprised as you are, but there you go. But yeah, he was then, the only acting credit he's got in 2024 is Not Another Church Movie, which I assume, I mean, it says it's not a Tyler Perry movie, so it's trying to position itself as a Not Another film, but not a Not Another film, which is meta on all sorts of levels, but I'm not going to watch it. And then this year, he, as I mentioned earlier, unretired Cameron Diaz.
Right.
In a film called Back in Action, which was a Netflix film. I have not seen it. Don't care to, but
that was a Looney Tunes film with Brendan Fraser.
Back in Action?
Yeah, Looney Tunes, Back in Action, 2003.
I remember the name of it only.
Timothy Dalton is in it as his dad.
Okay, well, fine.
Yeah.
So Jamie Foxx's dad, no, actor you mentioned. So fine. But also in that film, interestingly, is Moriarty / Hot Priest, Andrew Scott, and Stathlet's Flats, and another Fleabag cast member, Jamie Dimitriou, who I always find entertaining. So there's that.
I've ever seen
Jamie Dimitriou, no. Or Fleabag. You've never seen Fleabag?
No.
Turn this off right now and watch Fleabag. It's amazing.
Good night, everybody.
Goodbye. She tell me, boy. Oh, no, it's a different thing. Anyway, and then he's got another one coming up soon. But he's kind of seems to have fallen into the same career trajectory as a lot of our kind of more venerable actors, where he's gone from being acting in lots of stuff to then taking the realms as a producer and in some guises starting to direct as well.
Yeah.
So very much kind of evolving his career beyond his screen talents and, you know, fair play to him. He still kept up some TV roles here, there, and everywhere along the way. His music career kind of peaked in the kind of noughties. And actually, that's I asked you when you first heard of him. You didn't ask me back, so I'll tell you.
All right.
I first heard of him when Adam and Joe joked about him on their XFM radio show.
Oh, okay.
That his lyrics were just overtly sexual, including the lines, "There'll be puddles in the bed." In a weather-themed sex romp song.
Wow.
Hilarious fun. But yeah, he's got a lot of strings to his bow, has that there, Jamie Foxx. And it doesn't look like his star's going to be on the decline anytime soon.
I mean, health notwithstanding.
Health notwithstanding, and I gather he has had some legal issues. But that's by the by.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think when you say he's had a trajectory that we've seen quite a lot of, that being said, they have had considerable success coming up through the 90s and then in the first two decades of this millennium, and then just doing films I've never heard of on the basis that he's 57. Therefore, no longer front and centre in the most mainstream of roles, I'd say.
Sure. But I mean, I guess that's why we pick these people for the films, or for the podcast, rather.
True.
Because, you know, we want someone with a big body of work, and what are they still doing? I mean, he's still acting. He's still going.
Yeah.
He's not completely hung up his codpiece. What do they call it when actors retire?
Not that.
I mean, if it wasn't a thing before, I'd like to make that a thing.
Well,
he's hung up his codpiece.
Just get it into the zeitgeist, brother. And,
yeah, absolutely. So could everyone please start using the phrase hang up his codpiece?
Yes.
And
also try and think of a female equivalent as well.
Yeah, I'm sure women wore codpieces when they were playing men. No, hang on, that was just Shakespeare in Love. So, do you know, the other day...
I wouldn't put it past Paltrow either.
I learnt what a jerkin was. Do you know what a jerkin is? It's like a kind of tunic, but more so.
Right.
And I was reading my book, and it kept talking about wearing his jerkin or wearing her jerkin.
Right. So,
what is a jerk? It sounds like some kind of codpiece. Maybe it's got codpieces on the brain.
You might be thinking of a merkin.
Why is it at the end of every podcast, even when we take weeks to record the fucking thing, I keep going to pot and go crazy at the end of an episode?
It's because you have a nearly 10-year-old daughter. And...
this episode sponsored by the letter jerkin.
What?
And the number codpiece.
Right. Okay.
Oh, God. Anyway, so Jamie Foxx, any last things to talk about with Jamie Foxx that we haven't already covered?
Jerkin
Foxx. With
Fox.
His discography, yep. And his film career and his beautiful bank accounts and Victoria Silverstone Playmate of the Year. Fuck!
Yeah.
Anyways. Yeah. Good. We like Jamie Foxx.
We certainly do.
He's
a very outstanding talent.
He's a great guy, and I look forward to seeing him in more stuff, just not any of his recent films.
Sure. Okay. Well, again, as might have been hinted at, we've had...
To the future!
We've had some production issues over the summer, and indeed September. But don't worry, because whilst we... Quite rightly, don't have any feedback, as far as I know.
Which is fair.
Which is absolutely fair.
I think we asked for some earlier in the episode, but that was weeks ago, so I'm not sure.
Anyway,
please send us feedback.
Yes.
We love you. Tell us how much you love us.
Yep.
Because we need reinforcements, so much so that some of us have started doing stand-up comedy.
Yes, because I love it when people don't laugh. it's like, who here's heard of Singing in the Rain? Ooh, there. Right.
Chirps.
And you can't necessarily say, well, that's my act, buggered, and walk off. Anyway.
No, you persevere and they go, well, that's my time, bye.
Yep. That is what I do.
Which
anyway.
Works fine.
Yeah, you know, you soldier on. So that's hey@earth-2.net to send us an email. That's hey@earth-2.net. And also, we have a Facebook page, and pay attention to that, because that's going to become quite relevant for reasons we're just about to get into.
Yeah, I mean, you say pay attention, it's gone up by the time this episode's released.
Sure, but we are drawing attention to that for people who don't have it regularly show up on their feed. And again, why would they have given the last 3 months? So the next episode is going to be all about Robert De Niro.
His name is Bobby.
Ambitious, yes. But have we got 100 episodes under our belt? Also, yes. Should we have done him earlier? Possibly. But
I don't know if, you know, the natural progression is Evangeline Lilly and then Robert De Niro.
Exactly. You know, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. So, yes. So obviously there's quite the body of work, and thank you to everyone, who has, pitched in with ideas. So, we've got two things down for definite, and we are going to appeal to you for help with our third and final choice. So let's get the definitive things out of the way first. So I'm opening the next episode. So the film I had never seen before. Brother, what have you picked for me?
I have picked for you, brother, a hilarious rom- even more relevant to you now, brother, with your chosen new career. I've chosen for you the King of Comedy.
That's very kind. It's more of a hobby. But,
because, you know, you need to learn some more skills. I've sent this to you.
Okay, thank you.
You'll learn everything you need to know.
Thank you. My comedy training will be complete. I will then be a Jedi.
And what have you chosen for me then, brother? What do I need to learn about?
Are you talking to me?
I am talking to you, yes.
I can't see anyone else here, so you must be talking to me. That's right. It's Taxi Driver.
Oh, it's that famous line.
It is, yes. I wasn't being rude for the sake of it.
No.
I can do that for other things. Anyway, so the joint review slot, we have whittled it down to three choices because for Robert De Niro... We think you'll forgive us this slight indecision because we're not having another year of Redux for a good long while. So we are considering three options. Brother, do you remember what those options are?
So let me explain some of these.
Sure.
Obviously, he's got huge filmography. And, you know, we've talked about some of his high-profile early work from the 70s and the 80s, and then what do we do for the third film? Because obviously he's got so many films to pick. A lot of films that we could pick could also be picked for other actors as well, including potentially a Christmas episode with Scorsese, because they've been shacking up for years and years and years. So in order to try and gauge what could be a third film, we've gone to the late 90s and the noughties. No, we haven't. The early 90s and one from the noughties. So in order to choose the third film, your choices are the 1990 film Goodfellas, which I gather is kind of popular.
I have seen that one before.
Fine. The 1991 film Cape Fear, which I've technically seen because I've seen the Simpsons episode that is based off it.
Indeed.
or it parodies. Or... we go completely tonal shift and talk about, or use it as a way of kind of looking at his broader comedy credentials or the films that he then ranges into. Meet the Parents from the year 2000. We can't decide. And obviously there are so many other films we could pick for a third film. Some of them we will cover with other people, I am sure. But we need your help to pick our third film. So a poll has gone live on our Facebook page. You can choose... whichever of them you want. There are multiple choice. What I'd ask you to do is not choose all of them, because that doesn't help us at all. But we will choose our third pick out of what you say. We're going to have to put a hard cap on it so that we can watch it and review it in a timely manner. I'm going to put the deadline for answering our call out as the 5th of October. So yeah. If you could please reply and put in your, throw your oar in, cast your pebble, by the 5th of October in the year of our Lord 2025, you can dictate content on our episode.
Yes. So, that gives us the onus to finish the edit, lickety split, and therefore...
I've done most of it for you.
Yeah, all right, fine. Yes, we will be very interested to hear what you have to say about that. So, well, leaves us with nothing more to say. Thank you for bearing with us. Once again,
much appreciated.
We'll try and up the ante a bit more because we do still have our John C. Reilly Tomlinson's pick to go over, and
indeed,
I'm aware we've covered But One Woman this year.
Ah.
So, might be thinking we will have a female for the Christmas episode.
A female.
Female.
We will see what we can do.
yes, indeed.
But all that remains for us to say is we love you. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day wherever you are. Congratulations to Preston on the release of his book. That's incredible. I look forward to reading it at some point.
Yes, congratulations, Preston. It's a big achievement. So
it's awesome.
Well played.
And it sounds right up my street, so I'm looking forward to it.
Good stuff. Right then. Until next time, whenever that might be. Cheerio!
Cheery bye, everybody!
Citizen is a 2009 vigilante action thriller film starring Jamie Foxx.
Does he?
I just said Jamie Foxx.
Jamie Foxx.
Yeah. Well, he does have children. Let's start that again.
Have you heard his musical career? He fucks.